Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Kernels. If my voice sounds a bit different this week, that's because it is different. I am not Chris Hooton, the usual host. I am Jacob Stowervie, who's appeared on the podcast quite a few times over the past few years. Chris, the film that Chris has been talking about quite regularly, is finished. I've seen it with my own eyes, as has Jack Shepherd.
Hello.
How are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
Good. So we thought it'd be a good idea this week to speak to Chris and his co-director, David Rapson.
Hello.
How are you?
Very well, thank you. Glad to be here.
Good. Good to have you here. And just ask you guys about the experience of making a film, because we've actually seen, haven't we, Jack?
We have.
Yeah.
Which is quite terrifying for me, because I work with you guys a lot, and we watch a lot of fantastic films most weeks. So if you have to have you guys in a screening of a little, tiny, small-budget film I've made was a bit terrifying.
Yeah.
And I was also too drunk to remember your initial reaction to the screening. So what you say today is going to be of extreme interest. So.
Yeah. Great. Chris was very merry when we arrived. I love that. It was great. And like you say, I didn't actually think about that. It must be weird sitting next to us watching other people's films and then talking about it with us, but then having us there and others there to actually talk about your own film. That's quite kind of bizarre.
Yeah, it was a really, really weird night. I really enjoyed it, but I was a little bit nervous, hence the drunkenness, I think. But it was quite nice because I've played in bands before where you have to get on stage, ultimately is to do the thing, and actually the performance is there in the moment, so you've got to be on it. But it was actually quite nice for once to be like, everything's done, all someone needs to do is hit play, and you could actually sit back and relax and enjoy a little bit more.
Yeah,
so that's fun being on the other side of the screening process.
Definitely. And how did you feel about it, Dave?
Equally nervous, sort of sat at the bar next to Chris. It was weird, like, fizzing excitement of nerves, I kept standing up and like walking around to, because all of the actors and the crew were there on the night, and I remember like occasionally like walking over to one of the lead actors, Martin, for example, and tapping him, being like, oh, this bit, you're really good at it, by the way, which is a stupid thing to do during a screening, but I was just like, I was like a puppy, I was so excited. But equally share Chris's like super nerves, because there were bits when you maybe expected like a big reaction because you're so proud of a certain bit and it doesn't quite land, and then another bit gets a huge reaction. So it was quite surprising, really terrifying, but ultimately like seriously one of the best nights of my life. It was like really, really fun to like share something and get a reaction.
Who are you most nervous about watching it?
Pardon me?
Who are you most nervous about seeing it?
I guess like friends who weren't involved in the process, because like your peers, you're almost like worried about their reaction. Any friends who came along, because there were quite a lot of friends who came in the film as like extras, or a couple of people like stepped up to the plate and actually had speaking parts, and they were all there and they could see how it came about and how it was such a fun thing to do. Whereas like when you tell someone that you're friends with, like, oh, by the way, we made a film, there's a slight concern about their reaction about it, and then actually putting it out there. And as Chris says, like, you know, usually when you recommend a film to someone, it's like, oh, I've got this great Wes Anderson film that we're going to recommend, you're really going to like it. And this time it's like, yeah, we've got this micro-budget film that me and my buddy made. I hope you like it. So there's a certain apprehension with sharing with people our age, I guess.
Yeah. We should probably actually talk about the film.
You talk about what? Yeah. And tell us what it's about.
We should. We
and the name.
Okay, that's very true. So, Meniscus.
Yes.
Meniscus is a name. Tell us about that name and that title. Very memorable title.
Yeah, meniscus is a word someone told me in a bar a couple of years ago. The name for when you fill a drink, say a beer, particularly full to the point where it forms like a surface tension dome, and that surface tension is being held in place by what surrounds it. And it was just kind of the idea. I mean, there is a lot of beer in the film, a lot of beer being consumed, a lot of beer being consumed on the set as well. And
nice.
The whole idea of surface tension is kind of metaphorically a little bit what the film was about, you know, and that kind of awkwardness. So that was the thinking there.
Sure. And when did the title come in?
Quite early on, actually. I think it was just like a working title for a while. And we were developing the script and we're like, actually, just stick with it. Like, it's kind of interesting. Makes you maybe want to Google it, or like kind of have some clarification on it. So
it's funny exactly you
what,
say that.
It's exactly what me and Jack did.
Yeah, we messaged each other before, though, didn't we?
Have you looked at meniscus?
The day of the screening, we were like, "Let's." I don't even know what meniscus is.
Unfortunately, it's also the name for like a kneecap.
Yeah, that's what we saw.
Some people Google it and be like,
"We were wondering what was going to happen." What kind of film is this?
I was rolling with it. So tell us what it's about, as well.
So shall I give the blurb, Dave?
Yeah, go for it.
It's just a 60-minute film about people in and out of love in London and kind of the idea that the grass is greener on the other side, or the grass is fucking phenomenally technicolor on the other side, depending on what mode of life you're in. Often when you're single, you're thinking, you know, I miss what it's like being in a relationship, and you're kind of yearning for that. But then you can get into a relationship and be like, oh, being single seems so magical and like mystical and like fun. So we just kind of wanted to explore that really and do it in a way. So we wanted to have four characters that are all in different stages of that process. And then I was really interested by the idea of splitting the screen into four so that the action never, ever cuts away. Because I like the idea, and I think it's true, that you might have a blazing row or you might have sex with someone and then they might just go and make a cup of tea and then they might come back later and then something else dramatic happens again. And I thought it was quite nice to chart that happens in between, whereas in films it's usually just bang, that scene's ended, let's go and find out what's going on in the other subplot. So yeah, it's about these four people, and then we kind of work out that they all know each other, they're all friends, and they're all hungover, and they're all supposed to be going to a party in the afternoon, and that's where it kind of leads to.
It's funny, when me and Jack were before the film began, someone came up to us, or someone relayed to us that it had been described to them as a like a Linklater version of 24. And I was like, that completely speaks to my interest.
I love that.
It speaks to my interest. So I was really hyped. But it really is. What did you make of the screen split into four?
You can be quite worried before. I was slightly worried beforehand that it was going to be either you wouldn't be able to see anything, or you would be concentrating on one you're not supposed to be concentrating on. But actually it went really nicely from one screen to the other. Like, there are bits where you have someone sending a text, and then it's quite obvious when the speech kind of pops up on someone else's screen and your eyes automatically go down, so you always know where you're supposed to be looking. But then you're also kept in attention the whole time. Like, if someone's just having a chat in a bedroom, you look over to another screen and suddenly you see someone throwing their dog like a ball or something, so you're constantly kind of, there was something going on, something to look at. So
yeah,
it was quite a sensory overload at some points, perhaps.
Yeah, I was not sure how it was going to turn out. I wanted to make the other corners interesting enough that your eyes might wander and they're like welcome to, but not so interesting that you're distracted. So I wanted them doing quite mundane things, you know, like one character's asleep for like 40 minutes of the film, that sort of thing. But
I'm glad that sensory overload came through as well. I mean, Chris mentioned it's about sort of like a feeling of, there's a lot going on. These people are always comparing themselves to other people, and as a viewer, you're literally comparing them. That's certainly intentional, as we sort of like built the narrative around that framework. And if it's slightly bamboozling as you're watching it, but not too bad that you can still follow it, that's the perfect amount of confusing.
Yeah, I think only at tiny moments.
Sorry, usually like we are comparing ourselves to other people's lives, aren't we, on our phones and on other screens? So to have that kind of worked in that sense, maybe, I hope.
What I like in things in general, and I know this sounds like something really, really silly to say and really obvious, but like in TV shows, I just love when you kind of meet characters and see them interact with other characters later on down the line. And in this, it's kind of like you see all the characters and they don't meet, and then they all do collide, and it is like I'm kind of waiting for, it's not attention so much as I'm looking forward to seeing how they interweave into each other's lives. I think that film, your film, has that from frame one, like, and it kind of keeps it throughout.
I'm delighted to hear that.
Thank you very much. And I was going to ask as well, the editing, I mean, must have been quite a process.
It was,
because you're not just editing one.
You must have hours of footage, like hours and hours and hours.
Yeah.
What did you say the other day? It was like four films for the price of none.
Yeah.
Put that on the poster. Yeah.
4 hours of edited footage with no money. It was like all the we called the active storylines were fine. They all slotted together fairly nicely, but all the passive stuff was difficult, because those were the bits where we had to cut corners, you know, when someone's just walking the streets of London for a while. And that's where we found ourselves like short on coverage, or something didn't work quite right. And it was quite getting that patchwork together at the end. That was all the scenes came together. Like, I was really like pleased. I edited it quite quickly, but then those bits were difficult. And sound as well was an issue with that, and moving sound between different corners, which isn't something, not something you ever normally have to do, was pretty difficult as well. But yeah, those shoots were quite punishing for those corners. We did those last, and there was a lot of people that we had to be like, sorry, but you need to be here at 8 a.m. to walk around the streets for like 2 hours so we can just get enough like footage for this.
Was it summer when you were doing it?
It was middle of winter.
Was it the middle of winter? No way. You've got good friends.
God bless like the DOP, Kyle Chase. He put in a lot of hours just shooting continuous takes up until like the camera caps off at 15 minutes, just keeping going.
Really?
So we had enough coverage, but yeah.
Basically drinks are on you boys whenever you're out, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
That's really cool. We should talk about, you mentioned sound, and I don't know about you, Jack, but part of my biggest takeaway from like the film was the soundtrack. It was amazing. Instantly you want to just kind of go home and put it on Spotify, but I don't think we can.
That's
can
good
we?
To hear. We hope to, I think. Yeah, I think we want to get it on Spotify. It was done by my friend Julian, who used to play guitar in my band, and he's really, really talented guy. And I think the kind of the references were like Kurt Vile, Tobias Gesso Jr., then also some kind of like 60s rock as well, something a bit like lackadaisical. And
I really like that song Jealous Guy, John Lennon, and these sort of like kind of sad piano chords. But Julian absolutely nailed that, because we played him a few tracks like that, and Kurt Vile, kind of stuff that me and Chris listen to. I suppose you can call it a bit slackery, which I suppose kind of fits in with what kind of film it is. It's not naturally fitting into many genres. I suppose mumblecore as a genre is kind of close to what we were doing, a lot of like narrative and dialogue heavy, so those sort of like slightly downbeat songs played well. But for Julian, he absolutely nailed it. By we played him a few tracks that we really liked, that me and Chris discussed about how they're quite similar to the sort of characters, showed Julian the footage, and Julian actually, of course, like worked on the film while we were there, was there while it was happening, showed him key scenes and said, right, we need a song that sounds like what these two are going through right now. And for a first time original soundtrack, he's absolutely
score.
Nailed it.
Yeah, there's a really impressive. Nice moment actually where there's a scene where a guy goes to his ex-girlfriend's house and he ends up kind of like brushing her hair and sort of sensual, they shouldn't be doing this way. And I thought the score, the music he did for that was really good. And I told him so, and he was just like, yeah, man, I've been that guy. He kind of actually meant something to him that scene. So I think that helped him with the music on it, which was quite sweet.
That is nice.
So if we talk, let's talk about the characters for a second, if you don't mind. Like what was the process of you creating them and coming up with them? Like, did one of you kind of take the lead on that, or was it a very collaborative effort?
So I kind of took the lead on the script, but I think the good thing about working with Dave is like I'm very much single in my life and have been throughout the meniscus experience, and Dave got married during it, so
married man.
We have people on very different sides of the split, so sometimes I can be too cynical and he can rein me in, and it works in the other way too. So there are characters that I maybe identify with a little bit more, and then characters you probably do a bit,
right?
So I think in terms of having that idea of a character that is in each possibility of in and out of a relationship, we kind of zeroed in on a character maybe that we each kind of felt more akin to.
Certainly, or at least friends. Yeah, I guess to answer your question, it came about through us talking about each other, as we're like extremely close friends, have been since school. Lots of friends who worked in the film. There was a lot of relationships in this film, you know, people who made the music, who we wrote it together, people who acted in it. And where those characters came from is us talking about our lives, our friends' lives and stuff like that. That all came quite naturally, and by way of, it's sort of similar to what we were saying earlier about like those comparisons, you know, we talk about people looking and compare each other's lives and stuff, and yeah, we do try and like remind each other, if you have a bit of a moan about one thing, you know, remember to see a bit of perspective, which hopefully comes through in the film. Like there are times when single characters are talking about how they just crave a bit of stability. There are times when characters in like the long-term relationships in the film are craving that freedom, and then when these characters eventually like meet up and have a bit of a dialogue about that, that's conversations that me and Chris have kind of had. So those characters were like very naturally formed. About like
there were definitely people in the screening room actually who I kind of was thinking about when I was writing the script as well.
Really?
It was just kind of worrying. It's like, are they going to see themselves in this? Because you know everything you write is autobiographical to some extent. It's just, you've been absorbed in some way by that osmosis because it's someone near you, or
more so for you, Chris, because you actually ended up playing one of the characters.
You did indeed.
Yeah.
So when did that decision come about?
that was partly by necessity of limited budget, and if you can play a character in your own movie, like, you should, because it's just so much cheaper. Like, and you know that you're broadly going to get, you're not going to be able to bring a different element like an actor will, but you know you're going to get the part because you wrote it. Mm. And also, you know that you're going to be there at 8 a.m. sharp, no matter what, going to give 110% because it's your thing. Mm. So I think when you're strapped with budget, it's just a no-brainer to do that if you feel like you can. And I wasn't really sure if I could, but I feel like it came off all right.
It did. Have you got a previous acting experience?
No, I've only done a few classes. And Martin in the film as well, who plays Anish, he's a stand-up comic. He'd never acted before either. But
wow.
I couldn't really judge myself because, you know, you're too close to it. But yeah. I felt like I could judge him, and I thought he'd put in as good performances like all the professional actors in it. So
I agree. I think maybe you're not giving yourself enough credit. Like, I know it was quite an academic choice to act as Tom, because it lent well to the parts of the film that, like, you wrote most naturally. But I think you did an amazing job. And Martin as well, who's a stand-up comic, as you say. We mentioned Julian earlier, who, like, this is his first time making a soundtrack. There's quite a bit of like amateur success in Meniscus.
And, yeah.
And a few people who have gone on really well, like people who worked on Meniscus, which was, you know, made, like, we started making it, you know, 18 months ago, I guess, maybe longer. There are guys who, being in their, like, mid-20s, late-20s, in 18 months have now, like, gone on from strength to strength. Like,
it was like they were doing it as, like, a bit job or, like, a hobby at that point, and now they're, like, on sets every day, which is really, really, like, nice to see.
Yeah, Kelby's in LA now.
Yeah, yeah. People, you're like, well, we couldn't get you now because you're now, like, a big deal and doing it.
Oh, yeah. You try and assemble the cast and crew of Meniscus now, and, like, you absolutely can't. Like, really? We couldn't get them all to the screening because they're working. They're doing... It was, you know... It was a real time for loads of people who are just getting started in film, getting together, and people have gone on to be absolutely smashing it by now.
That's really exciting.
Yeah, it's really exciting to watch.
Yeah.
So how did you go about getting these people together?
That's really where the internet's great. Like, you couldn't have done this like 15 years ago. It's all online.
Yeah, some of the parts we cast from actors we knew and then actor friends of theirs. But yeah, online as well. Yeah. I mean, yeah, a lot of people had to work for free or only work for expenses, but I like to think that we did right by them. And, you know, off the back of this, you know, most of them seem to be really pleased with it and really want to, like, use the footage to and use the film to help them get where they want to go. So,
there are websites, I'm sure there are numerous, but what we did was there's a website where you can put your script up, certain parts of the script anyway, excerpts, and actors can read the script and say, oh, I actually like this role, for example, and then someone basically send you a message saying, like, I'd like to read for this role. Then they can, through this, like, online portal, send you a video of them reading a certain bit.
I think I put up, like, a couple of characters that we still had left to cast, and then wasn't really sure what would come of it on this site, Casting Call Pro, and then woke up the next morning and there were 150 applications in my Gmail, some of them with video attachments of them reading the script and stuff. And it's like, and it's simultaneously, you feel bad that there's so many people looking for unpaid work like that, and you don't want to be exploitative, but at the same time, it's great that there's so many people who are out there just looking to do it, like, for the love of the project and for art. And yeah,
it was really validating, because I think at the point when you've got a script, you don't know if you're going to have a film. You know, it's one, anyone can, like, get together with a mate and write a script about, you know, wouldn't it be cool if this character did this, and these are very relatable scenarios. But at that point, you do not have a film. And when actors started sending in videos of themselves reading parts, it starts feeling more tangible, and actually we got a bit of momentum then. I certainly did. Like, it went from being something that might happen to, we're making a film. People want to do this. So that point was incredible, and made it all the more real.
It's almost like, because it's you're not just letting yourselves down if you don't do it. You've got this whole unit of
that's massively it.
Yeah,
you owe it to yourself. And not just, like, people, but, like, locations as well. Like, one of the places we shot at was this place called Red Church Brewery. It's, like, one of me and Chris's favourite hangouts. Really great place to go and drink beer, and it's one of our favourite spots. And they let us film in their brewery. They just opened it up to us, and they were like, they're very cool, relaxed people. And they were like, yeah, of course, you can shoot on this day.
Yeah, like, as long as you're out by 5 and we open it as a bar, like, that's fine.
Right.
They're like, you won't need to pull pints during the shoot, that's fine. They were really accommodating.
That's
really
terrific.
Nice.
And, you know, you've got, at one point we had, like, 50, 60 people on set. You've got a responsibility to make sure we get what we need, certainly for the film, but also that people are having an enjoyable experience and that ultimately it's worth it. So you want to get the shot that absolutely makes it the best it could be.
Yeah.
So we weren't just taking the first take every time. We were like, no, we can do that slightly better. And, you know, DOP, Kyle being very, very patient. But, yeah, I think the more you sort of take on to set, the more you owe it to everyone on set. Mm.
Speaking of Linklater before, have you seen the film Everybody Wants Some? Have you seen?
I've never seen that. I think I watched half of it on a plane to my, which is bad of me. I need to pick it up.
You do. I think you would like that film certainly. But there's a lot of party scenes in that film where you can just tell they're having such a good time. Mm. You guys having the pressure of having to direct those scenes, was it kind of less of a fun time, more kind of like, right, we need to get this done?
It was funny, actually. Mm. So like the scripted scenes at the party where all the extras had to be obviously completely directed by one of the ADs and exactly what they were doing, that was a bit more of a nightmare. Mm. But we then had this moment where we were in between setups, I think moving from like the living room to a kitchen. And in between, all of the extras, you know, some of which were our friends, were just drinking beers and like having a good time and throwing things around. We just whispered to like the camera operator, like, do you want to just go and skirt around that quickly? And obviously, it wasn't like it was clandestine because you could see a camera going around. So people knew what was happening, but they just let it happen and tried to continue just having fun as they were. And we're like, right, we can just get all the crowd shots like by doing this.
That's true.
And that was really cool, actually, because you can't get a more authentic feel for a party than if people actually just having a party and you just go around with a camera.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I know what I'm like. I'd be like, wee. I would have been awful. I think it's a good time to say me and Jack, we have a cameo in the film.
There we go. Yeah, we do, don't
yeah,
we?
Do. Yeah. Blink and you miss it cameo.
Very brief. Just, what are we? They're like Facebook friends. No, we're on your version.
We're on your dating app. Is it a fictional dating app in the film?
It is, yeah. Just because we weren't sure about rights for that.
But, our pictures, we were happy to give.
Unfortunately, because of the narrative, you guys had to be swipe lefts, but that was only by necessity. Otherwise, you know, you guys would have been a like all day long.
She's a sensible character. She's a sensible character.
She senses trouble.
Yeah. What do you want? What do you want people to kind of, when they see the film, what do you want them to go away thinking, feeling?
I was delighted that people related with it. A friend of mine from Germany came and watched the film, and he wasn't involved in the making of it. He was seeing it for the first time at the screening, and he kept laughing, his big loud German laugh during the film. And afterwards, he came over to me. He was like, "So much of that is exact conversations that I've had with my girlfriend and situations I've been in," and gave me a big old earnest hug. Aww. And that was just wicked.
Yeah.
Like, and so now we're sort of like putting it out there a bit.
People saying it made them feel uncomfortable was like the biggest compliment, I think, because everyone's going to come up to you and say it was good, to just like save your feelings. But you know, if someone was like, "I found that really hard to watch," like, you know, it's resonated with them on a, yeah.
I guess that's, I don't know, I think that that's all you can really ask for. If people get what you were trying to put out there, that's the ultimate reward. Like, if people say that they found it a certain bit awkward, and me and Chris know how much we tried to make that very, very awkward for that character, or there's an argument where two characters literally argue about the emojis they use, and like somebody said to me, like, "Oh my God, I've actually had that exact argument." Fantastic. Like, if we can put something out there that people actually have had similar experiences to, then like that's a great goal for us, really.
Yeah. And what's the plan? What's happening?
Well, we're just starting a festival run at the moment. We're going to see what we can do with it. It's like when you're working with a no budget, there's kind of a ceiling in a sense, really, because it's always going to look a little bit rough around the edges, and that's going to block you out of certain things from the get-go. But get out on the festival, see if we can get some distribution, see if we can get it out on VOD, hopefully, for listeners who've made it this far. You'll have the chance to watch it if you're interested to at some point, but we'll see how it goes and then see if people see the potential in it, and next time around we could do something with a bit of money behind it and make it look, you know, absolutely top grade.
And what's the running time again, the full running time?
60 minutes. 60 minutes is awkward because it's neither a short nor really a feature. It's technically classed as a feature, but you don't get many that short.
So. Oh really, is that how it works?
Yeah, anything according to like Ampus, it's like anything over 40 minutes is a feature, but that's pretty short.
It's a manageable feature.
Yeah.
Manageable feature.
Well, I mean,
for millennials with short attention spans.
Yeah, and also, you know, we're first-time directors, so if our first one was 3.5 hours, there'd be a big collective sigh, like, these guys.
There's actually a lot of festivals that won't accept features over 2.5 hours.
Fair play.
Really? Like, no.
No way.
I agree. It's a low investment, you know. You can say to people, you got an hour? Yeah, you can watch Meniscus. Yeah.
An hour is a good time, I think.
Yeah.
I was going to say, it's quite ambitious going straight in for, like, a first film at 60 minutes. Do you guys didn't try any short films or anything first?
It was kind of part of the challenge for me. I was just like, it's expected that you can do a short film and you can pull that off in like a shorter space of time. I was like, no, I want to put in the time and get a feature done, because it's like a lot of time and a hard thing to do, and I wanted that sense of pride of having finished something longer, I think. But having said that, I now really want to do a short, just so, because we did end up stretching ourselves really thin on a lot of elements, rather than now I'd like to just do something where everything can be perfect, because it's, you know, only 20 minutes and there's no reason for it not to be, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I don't think, we didn't start with the format of like wanting to make an hour long thing. We started with the idea of having the four characters and the split screen, and from there it needed to be as long as it needed to be. Before Meniscus, we were planning on making something else entirely. We were going to shoot something in an airport that we just couldn't do because we couldn't find the right airport to film it in. So we ditched that, and then we wrote Meniscus. Had we done the airport thing, that might have been a half an hour thing, yeah. I think.
I kind of, in the back of my mind, had this thing as well when interviewed the Netflix CEO, where he was like, we'll take things of, you know, whatever length, and like even episodes in a season, like why not one be 15 minutes and the other be 3 hours? And I kind of had that in mind. I was like, well, why don't we just write it and it come out the length that it is? Why try and restrict it to certain time limits? So
exactly.
Kind of that.
So we're going to see Meniscus on Netflix, is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Hopefully. That'd be great, wouldn't it?
That'd be lovely.
That'd be very
Reed
nice.
Reed Hastings, if you're listening.
Yeah, Reed, Ted, come on, guys.
Well, thanks, guys, for indulging us with this. It's been fun to talk about.
Oh, our absolute pleasure. I was going to ask Jack what his final takeaway of the film is.
Yeah, and give me your honest takes. I need them.
Oof. On the spot now, Jack.
Oof, yeah.
If anyone can give some harsh honesty, as Jack
Shepard. Yeah, it's true. The harshest critic there is.
Harshest critic. That's a big name to live up to. It's difficult because I feel quite close to the project, even though I wasn't like part of it, because you are. And I think in it, I could see bits of you.
Yeah.
Sorry, Dave, I don't really know you, but
right.
I could see, like, there were certain bits of dialogue, especially where I was like, that is such a Chris Hooton thing to say.
Definitely.
I think there was one line where it was like, oh, we're not stalagmites and stalactites or something. And I was like, yeah, I can see him saying that. So it's quite difficult to kind of take yourself away from that. But even, you know, everything we've said about it being relatable and just, you know, especially on the budget it was on, it's an incredible thing that you've done. Mm-hmm. So, and you've actually gone out and done it. I think, like, I've been talking about doing like a short film for ages, and only now am I finding going like, actually I do need to do this. And but you guys have actually like said, oh, we're gonna write a script and do it, and that's more than most people can say. So
yeah, and to get like proud. Sloppy about it, it made me feel really good doing it, even if we don't do anything with it. Like those days on set were some of the happiest I've had.
Yeah,
period. So
that's great.
It's good to, like, I recommend anyone out there to create, because I think it does make you feel good. It's endorphins.
I completely agree for two reasons. One, because particularly that last weekend of filming was like one of the best times of my life. It was incredible having all our friends around us, completing something. That feeling was amazing. But the second reason why it feels great is, to your point, is like actually like setting out to do something and doing it, which I think was also, I mentioned earlier about like driving forces once you get started. That was a real driving force. Like, I can't not complete this. We wanted to make a film, so like, not stopping until it was complete was where our heads were really at. And the idea of like, can we write and direct a film was a big like challenge. And the fact that we just went and did it, and that, you know, technically on paper, we are now co-writers and co-directors of a film. And like, anybody who has an idea, like a short story, a short film, a band, whatever it is, which we've all had creative ideas, there's always that question mark of, are you gonna stop? And we didn't. We just got it done. And
yeah. Get out there and do it is the takeaway.
Yeah, do it, man. It's not that hard.
No,
yeah.
I can take that away from you.
Yeah.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found.
LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Something a little bit different. Me and Jack have been had a little project bubbling recently, which I know you guys know about, but if you don't mind us, little chat.
Talked about it, and then we did it.
Absolutely,
to a far lesser degree. Jack, do you want to describe what we're doing?
So Jacob. I'm not sure if you have mentioned it on here before. You probably have.
Well, I've definitely apologized for JJ Abrams a lot more than any normal person would.
But Jacob's a bit obsessed with the TV show Lost.
Yeah.
And
comes up on the desk in conversation most weeks, if not days.
Most days, I would say. Yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, it does.
And I've never watched it before.
Which was a crazy, crazy notion to me, considering his name is Jack Shepherd.
I love Lost. I did love it when it first came out. I haven't really watched it like I imagine you guys probably have, but I was very, very into it.
Yeah.
I watched 2 seasons with my dad and then dropped the fuck out of that.
Mate. So Chris is no longer part of his own podcast. So I realised that Jack, he shares the name of the lead character, for Christ's sake, and I realised that he had never seen an episode. He knew nothing about it, which I find that quite rare. Even if you don't watch Lost, you know things about it. And for me, I've watched it 7 times. And which is balmy. But the one thing that I love more than rewatching Lost is watching it for someone who's never watched it before. So I managed to strong arm Jack into agreeing to watch every single episode for a podcast,
about it on a podcast after every episode.
Every episode.
Do you realize what a grueling task you've put ahead of you yet? How many episodes have we got?
In all of Lost. I think there's 114, 115.
How many have you watched together?
We've watched 10.
Yeah, we're 10 down. I mean, I've never watched this show before, and now I'm promised to watch 140 episodes. It's quite intimidating.
But do you know what? We were out for beers the other day, and Jack was basically like, all I want to do is watch Lost. And for me, that's job done.
And then we did.
And then we were drunk and watched it and didn't record the podcast. So we need to probably rewatch that. But
I'm really glad that Jack didn't hate it and now just feels hamstrung into 140 episodes. Yeah,
that would have been probably a more fun listener, if he hated it.
I would love to listen to a podcast where you're begrudgingly there week after week, back with Jack.
Mental torture. But we are, I mean, we're called the Lost Boys, which is a
fantastic name.
It is, and it is courtesy of, I've got to say, my girlfriend who gets peed off because She's like, yes, she wants when we start getting, hopefully, things stuck. Picking up, look at me getting ahead of myself. I will say is the other day we got an email from a cast member who would like to appear on the show. I'm not going to say who, just yet in case it doesn't come off, but things like that are happening.
That's lovely.
I was next level obsessed when I was younger. It's really fun for me to do, and I'm just happy Jack's really up for doing it.
Funny story on Friday night when the guy who plays John Locke tweeted at you saying, and Jacob, the first thing he did was text me and go, oh my God, what should I write back?
I was like, I had a signed picture of him on my wall when I was 13. Literally, the old bald
with John Locke on his wall.
Terry O'Quinn. I'm like, what are you doing? But it lives and dies by Jack, basically. I think there's so many Lost rewatch of all these things out there, podcasts, of lots of TV shows. And I think without Jack's kind of willingness to delve into this crazy show that people do enjoy mugging off, without him it wouldn't work. So I feel like
you ever listen to those like Ricky Gervais podcasts with Carl Pilkington?
Of course.
I think I'm the Carl Pilkington in this situation. Like the guy doesn't know anything and is just going, oh, no fucking idea what's going on.
I like how esoteric the idea is, and I think you will find people who are involved in the production of like Lost who will be like, oh shit, it's cool that they're doing this. I want to revisit this with these guys. Yeah. I'm very into it.
Hopefully.
I hope so. But yeah, no, if anyone does want to listen along, we are the Lost Boys.
Where is it available? All good providers of podcasts?
iTunes and SoundCloud.
We just need those subscribes and those rates, really. Because we just want to... There's a lot of random little Lost podcasts that have been rolling around since it was on. But we want to alert people that we are new. We're providing fresh insight. And, you know, like... We do little spin-offs. Jack interviewed JJ Abrams the other week.
Cool.
you know, for the Cloverfield Paradox. So we're going to talk about other projects that people who are affiliated with Lost are part of as well.
That's nice.
So it's not just exclusive to Lost. So yeah, please do listen along.
Cool.
Good for you guys. Well done for getting it sorted.
Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
And well done to you guys for making it damn fun.
Stop. Right, well, let's
end this circle jerk going on.
talk about something that actually has a budget and is finished to a high quality, which is the Academy Awards.
The Oscars. The freaking Oscars.
Yeah, so I kind of wanted to do a little discussion with you guys about acting at its most elemental level, really. And I think we've talked about it before and how you know, when award season rolls around, awards often end up going to people playing historical figures, and particularly roles where they have to look very different. And so you know, the most recent example being Gary Oldman winning the BAFTA for playing Winston Churchill in The Darkest Hour. And you know, looking through the winners from the last years, with actress categories, it's not such a thing, because obviously there haven't been obviously as many female women in positions of power, therefore haven't been as many films where people have felt that their stories are deserving. So if you know, I mean, but even then there's still, you know, there's exceptions to that. So in 2006, Helen Mirren won for playing Queen Elizabeth II. Mm. The next year, Marion Cotillard for playing Edith Piaf, and fair play, she was great. That was a great performance. 2011, Meryl Streep won for Margaret Thatcher. But it's in Best Actor where it's really happening a lot. So you know, you've got 2014, Eddie Redmayne won for playing Stephen Hawking. The year before, Matthew McConaughey for Ron Woodruff. Not such a well-known guy, but still a real guy. Daniel Day-Lewis, a fantastic actor, won for Abraham Lincoln. His best performance, I don't know. Colin Firth in 2010 won for playing King George VI in The King's Speech. Sean Penn in 2008 for Harvey Milk. 2006, Forrest Whitaker for playing Idi Amin. The year before, Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Truman Capote. The year before that, Jamie Foxx playing Ray Charles, even though that was the year that DiCaprio played Howard Hughes, which I think is his best role. Mm. So yeah, I don't know what you guys' thoughts are on this, but I think there's something to be said for not confusing or like conflating good acting with impressions and being like transformative, and not confusing great makeup and hairstyling. And well, I don't know. What do you guys think makes for a good performance? A good where you're like, that is well acted.
It's very difficult.
It is.
Go on, Dave. You're a director. You should know.
Technically, I am. Yeah. I guess honesty and like something that's true to God. This sounds like I'm pushing my own film here about honesty and like true stories and feeling relatable. But yeah, I kind of don't really care who the character is and whether they're coming from like a position of me knowing them or not. Performances are idiosyncratic things. You might like them for like one particular niche little reason. I do worry that like some films of that ilk get overpraised because the portrayal is realistic or close to what people know a historical figure. Oh, that's exactly how he walked, or that's exactly how she spoke, and that's mimicry rather than necessarily being creative.
Yeah, that's what fascinates me about it, because like when you think about an actor signing on for a role and the work they've got to do before it gets to being on set, presumably, you know, if it's something like Winston Churchill, your job is like a research one. You're like, right, I'm going to go and look into this guy. I'm going to watch back endless, you know, videos, speeches, everything I can to try and get in that mindset and in that body feeling and the way of moving and everything. And that's obviously difficult to do. But I mean, take for example, you know, I would this year in the Oscar running, I would like Timothée Chalamet to win for Call Me By Your Name, or Daniel Day-Lewis to win for Reynolds Woodcock in Phantom Thread. And those are both examples where they've just been okay, you know, they might be adapted like Call Me By Your Name was, but in those situations people have just created from scratch. No character, you know, existed other than beyond the page, and they've brought them to life and made them feel like real people. Mm-hmm. And I always think I value that more.
It is about, it's all about, well, for me, it's all about the authenticity of it. And so this year, for instance, one of the great performances, I think, was Robert Pattinson in Good Time. Oh, yeah. And he just seems that authentically, like some bozos like living on the streets of New York or whatever. Like you believe him, and he's just created that out of nothing, basically. He's made this larger than life character who is just so mesmerizing. And you're right, both those people you've mentioned, especially Daniel Day-Lewis in Phantom Thread, he's created someone who you believe. And there must be, surely, like, the imagination an actor must have to do that, rather than just watching old videos of Winston Churchill and going, oh, I really need to nail this and really need to, you know, you're right when you said mimicry, it feels more like that rather than a creation of something new and something where you really do have to do your, you do research, but in a different way, you know, you kind of do the research and you take that in, but you don't just recreate something. I think Daniel Kaluuya, he said something really good. He said, when you rehearse before kind of acting, it was in that video we put on the Independent,
Black Panther,
for Black Panther. He was saying, you know, you kind of practice and practice. You don't necessarily, you learn the lines, you just practice and practice. And then when you're in front of the screen, it's like a musician, how they practice and practice, and then you kind of play it out on the day at the gig. Or if you're a football player, you kind of, that's all the practice put into it, and you perform there and then. And so he, you know, you basically are living that character. And that's in Get Out, that's someone he's created. Mm. Or at least he's taken someone's creation and done it. So I think it's...
I have no problem with people playing famous figures, of course. And no. I think Gary Oldman is terrific in as Winston Churchill. And I the problem I have is I kept forgetting it was Gary Oldman, which is amazing and impressive. But I'm fully aware that it's Winston Churchill. And for me, I just really, really appreciate roles more when I kind of remember an actor playing someone who is an original creation.
Yeah.
For example, like, just to say one example, I've got loads, but Oscar Isaac as Llewyn Davis in the Coen Brothers film Inside Llewyn Davis, who didn't even get nominated. But whenever I see him now in anything, it helps. I love that film a lot, but I don't think I would love that film as much without him in that role.
It's funny that you mention saying, like, I forgot that it was him, because that's the kind of the cliche that people always associate with good acting. They always say, like, oh, that part, I forgot it was this actor, you know. That's not necessarily what you want.
Exactly.
It really stuck with me when I was going back to when I was doing some acting training, and maybe it wasn't, like, popping for me, and then trying to be someone else. And then the tutor said to me, you will always be yourself. You are yourself playing that role, and you bring your you-ness to the role.
Mm.
And I think that's, like, important. So it's not about losing the actor, is about if you're still feeling like that actor's performance and it being memorable for that reason.
And it's also
that's exactly that's exactly what I was saying earlier about, like, so if a performance is just matching what we know to be true about a historic figure, I don't find that terribly interesting. But if you can bring your own spin on something and make it interesting, that's incredibly cool. And I think probably the best example of that in recent years would be Natalie Portman in Jackie, which was a bonkers film. I didn't actually love
it
as
a
film.
But she was good, wasn't she?
I actually saw that with you.
Yeah.
I didn't love that film, but it haunts me.
Yeah.
And her performance was, you know, she completely made her own thing of it, in that she had so much going on in her facial expressions and her eyes that were so personal to the actress that we know Natalie Portman to be. I thought that was so impressive in such a mature performance. Whereas, like, if she just stuck to researching videos of Jackie on YouTube and tried to mimic exactly, I wouldn't be as impressed. So, yeah, fair play to her for bringing that sort of so much to it.
Mm.
You know, I think that's the challenge. If you take on a fictional picture like that, you need to bring your own stuff to it and make it true to life so that everyone appreciates that that's what you're representing, but then put your own thing on it as well.
I think DiCaprio does that well as well with roles like J. Edgar. You know, he makes that his own.
God, I hate that film, though. That is the only DiCaprio film I actively dislike.
Really?
Yeah, Clint Eastwood, I just think he's useless now. It's funny you say about Jackie, I rewatched it the other night and I really like that film. So we're having conflicting opinions on things.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed that film, and I think it helps that the film is so strange. Like, it is such an odd beast as a film. And I think that helps when you've got someone who's just doing not the out and out biopic, or like Darkest Hour is, I like Joe Wright a lot, but it is very by the numbers, I guess.
His performance is a lot better than the film.
It is. I think it's well directed and stuff, but I think the film itself is just slightly unremarkable. But
you know
me,
what?
It's
sorry to jump in those biopic films, you know when at the end, after it fades to black and then it goes like, so and so 7 years later went on to do this and this. After it goes through those, I want him to say, read more on Wikipedia. That's just how it kind of feels.
Yeah. Yeah. It should just say, if you want to know what happened 7 years later, visit this website.
I guess it's like the opposite of like Scorsese films, because Scorsese films always feel like great novels, like great fiction, such bonkers characters, so deep. And then actually, if you compare it to biopics, they're just kind of you know, facts often are a bit more boring than fiction.
And Tarantino as well, you know. It's like he's making a film around Charles Manson, but you know it's not going to be a Charles Manson biopic. It's going to be a weird, idiosyncratic thing about LA in the 70s.
Yeah.
It also brings to mind, I saw an interview with Guillermo del Toro this morning where he's talking about casting Sally Hawkins in The Shape of Water. And he says when he casts an actor, he doesn't look at what they say. He's not interested in how they deliver their lines. He just looks at them when they're reacting to other lines, or when they're just, that's when he's looking at the performance. And that's such a world away from the kind of stuff that we're talking about in the kind of performances that we see getting perhaps overly awarded.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because what we should say as well, like the people who play real people who like exist, but they're not that famous, who've been part of like a traumatic experience. I mean, for example, Tom Hanks as Captain Phillips, which I think is one of the final 20 minutes of that, I think is 20 of the finest minutes Tom Hanks has ever given on screen. Because you don't know that, you don't have a point of reference, and they're bringing something else to a role, even though they've probably definitely spent a lot of time with that person to do them the justice they deserve, you know. So it's not just, it's kind of exclusive to people that, to famous historical figures. But I just, for me, it's someone who, like, you kind of, when you think about the actor, you automatically just think of the role that they've played. Like Ben Mendelsohn.
Oh, I love Ben Mendelsohn.
Who's incredible.
Yeah.
But like, he's played so many roles, and so many different, like, roles of like various disposition. Like, he's terrifying, or you just want to give him a cuddle.
He's always vulnerable a little bit.
Yeah, always vulnerable. But then in Animal Kingdom, he's so scary. He's not in it a lot, but he plays the uncle, right? And he's terrifying. That I got to interview him once, and it was incredible. It's like I just got to chill with him like in a park for a few hours, and I was just on the edge of my seat the whole time, because I was like, I feel like you're just gonna jump into that character right now. That's like an original, yeah. And it was probably based on someone, like just not a well known figure. But
so glad you mentioned Ben Mendelsohn. I was considering mentioning him earlier. He's like the antithesis of someone just like flatly playing someone from history. His performances always jump out at me. Like, he's that the older character in The Place Beyond the Pines.
Yeah.
Sort of like, he's the guy who won't go on the extra bank jobs. He's given a bit of sage advice. He's the old worn out dog. But there's something about his performance where he just has these lines that he delivers. Like, there's this bit when he's, I don't know if it's a spoiler or not. I presume everyone's kind of seen Place Beyond the Pines, but like,
is it old now?
It's fairly old. For it. Yeah. So he used to ride with Ryan Gosling, and he's now talking to Ryan Gosling's son, and he's describing how Ryan Gosling's character was when he rode motorbikes, and he just says, best, and he keeps saying it in this really idiosyncratic way. That's come completely from Ben Mendelsohn's performance and the way that he's interpreted this guy.
Mm.
And every time I've watched it a few times, you watch it back, that scene is so compelling and so honest and so real.
Mm.
And I think Ben Mendelsohn's someone that absolutely typifies that kind of actor that I really like. Someone who's going to bring so much character to the role. I can't believe you met the guy. Like,
It was years ago, and it was like early on in like, when I was just staring at him in disbelief just the whole time. He was like, "You're right, mate." And I was like, yeah. He was like, "I'm starting Rogue One tomorrow." I was I didn't even know you were in that. He absolutely does what you said. You mentioned Natalie Portman as Jackie. She brings something else to it. He's in Darkest Hour, Ben Mendelsohn, playing King George, the role Colin Firth won an Oscar for. And he's so odd in the role, and he's so great, and he's almost better than Gary Oldman.
Good.
But so he completely taps into what you were saying before.
He's not nominated for a supporting actor.
No, he's not.
He's only in it for a few seconds.
It's not a lot, yeah.
But I was going to say another biopic from this year, I, Tonya. With Margot Robbie, I think she's really great in that as Tonya Harding, and is just so weird and funny. And just, I know that film's got a few issues, but I think that's a great one. I think that's a really good example of kind of taking a character and doing something a bit weird with it.
Yeah.
Especially
as that film's very meta as well, in the rather than a straightforward like recounting a reenactment.
But I think that's way more interesting. It's been another example of that from this year was Disaster Artist, which was a bit odd.
Yeah.
And obviously James Franco, I mean, he was hyped a lot beforehand, and then stuff happened. But it's quite interesting. That was still a good performance. I still like that film.
Yeah, no, it's true. Well, yeah, as much as I'd like to see Timothée win. I mean, hopefully I think Frances McDormand's going to win Best Actress.
Right? She is.
And that's a very original part. So.
Yeah.
Then
I'd like to
see
Sally win, but yeah.
Yeah, I would too, actually.
Yeah. But Frances is great, and she'll give a great speech.
She will.
Yeah. So
And what did Madonna say, that only Francis could play that character?
Yeah.
There's something in that, like finding the perfect actor for the perfect role is a really commendable thing. And maybe she deserves it just for that, for like playing someone that she's so well suited to playing.
Mm. He said he wouldn't have made the film had she not been accepted.
That's cool.
Which is, yeah.
Special.
Special.
All right. Well, I just think we'll wrap things up. Thanks again for going on this tour with us around the film. Jack, Jacob, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thank you, guys.
And thanks, Dave, for coming on down. Nice to have you on Kernels.
Delighted to be here.
All right. Thanks for listening, guys. As ever, if you have any thoughts on any of all this and the acting on any fronts, drop us a tweet or an Instagram or whatever kind of social media you crazy kids are using these days. At Kernels mostly everywhere. All right. And we'll see you in a couple of weeks, probably some kind of post-Oscars-y fallout. And then we're going to have a live recording of Kernels coming up soon at the end of March. So we'll keep you posted on how you can get down to that if you're interested. All right. See you in a couple of weeks.